And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing, 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. Today is Wednesday, August 28th, 2019. I'm not quite sure how summer is speeding to a close, but it seems to be. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm doing a little survey. I would love to hear from you about authors you would like to hear from. I'd like to hear if you like the show's format, if you wish it were more chatty, whatever you think. Email me at penonfire@earthlink.net. You can subscribe to the show's podcast at iTunes or Stitcher, and when we upload a new show, it will arrive in your podcast file. On to the show. My guests today are novelists T. Jefferson Parker and Sigrid Nunez. Jeff is the author of numerous novels, including The Room of White Fire and Swift Vengeance. He's the winner of 3 Edgar Awards, a Seamus Award for Best Private Eye Novel, and a Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Mysteries. Before becoming a full-time novelist, he was an award-winning reporter. He lives in Fallbrook, California, and he's here today to talk about his latest novel, The Last Good Guy. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Barbara.
Hi. Great to have you back. I think you must get the award for being the author who's been on the show most.
Oh, good.
I think for just about every book of yours, I think you've been on.
I think you have, too. Great.
So let's start by talking about The Last Good Guy. This is the third in the series featuring investigator Roland Ford?
That's correct. Yep, number 3.
So tell me. Tell me about it.
Okay. It's a classic PI story updated for now, which is kind of what I set out to do with this whole series. It begins in kind of classic fashion with my PI, Roland Ford, sitting alone in his office, and what should happen, but an alluring, interesting young woman walks in and tells him a very sad story about her missing little sister, runaway 14-year-old who makes bad decisions, and she wants to know if Roland can help find the girl, and thus opens the tale.
So Roland Ford is such a compelling protagonist and hero, actually. I like him so much. I'm wondering what you think of him.
Yeah, good question. You know, I spent a lot of time thinking about Roland before I wrote a word about him when I knew that I was going to be writing a series at which he would be the center, you know. He's not only the center sort of story-wise, but he's also the storyteller. So I really spent a lot of time, you know, noodling him before I could even give him a name, you know. So I guess my take on Roland at this point after 3 books is that he's a big, capable guy physically. He's 38, he's 6'3", he weighs 210 pounds. He has a history of sports, of boxing in the Marines. He was a Marine in Fallujah. He was later a sheriff's deputy. So he's a tough guy. He's a capable, strong man. He's an earnest PI. He works hard for his clients. He knows what it's like to have someone missing from your life and how it can eat at you and how it can really take you down. So when he takes on a case such as this one where he's agreeing to help Penelope find her runaway little sister, Roland takes things kind of personally. And I think that gives him good weight within the books and stuff. He's not just a hired gun, and his moral compass is always true. I'm always trying to keep it true, and I'm trying to keep him entertaining. He's a bit of a wise guy, and I like that.
Is whatever current book you're working on, is the protagonist in that book your favorite?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, just the same way that whatever book I'm working on is my best, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to tell yourself that, and it's not always untrue, you know. I like a protagonist who can. I'm kind of a fan of the reliable narrator as opposed to the unreliable, mm-hmm. and I created Roland to be that. You know, when he tells you something is going on, that is going on to the best of his senses. You know, to judge, and he can be fooled, and he can be outfoxed. You know, sometimes temporarily, but he's always giving you the truth as he sees it.
Mm. You know, as I was reading, there were points where I was thinking about Chinatown the movie Chinatown, and I wondered what sort of effect that movie has had on you.
Oh, gigantic. I mean, I've been a you know, a devotee of that movie since I, you know, first laid eyes on it. I think I was in high school. I love that movie. I love the idea of moral corruption manifesting in civic corruption,
mm-hmm.
and business corruption, you know, surface corruption being kind of eaten away by a deeper darkness in some people. And so that's what Roland's up against. You know, I mean, on one level, he is looking for the girl. He's trying to find this missing person daily. But on another level, he is delving in kind of slowly but surely into the inner darkness of Penelope, who is the woman who hires him.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's really interesting. I really felt that on... I'm trying to find it now. I'm flipping through the book and I lost the page, but there was somewhere where I went. Okay, Chinatown. I love it. And there's also so much lyrical writing. And we probably talked about the influence poetry has had on your writing in the past. I don't know. I'm sure we've talked about it. But, you know, every so often I would underline something that has sort of a lyrical rhythm, like in chapter 20, the beginning. I think second paragraph. So I drove, looking for the tiny dot of hope, smaller than a taillight, but big enough to see. I mean, there's such rhythm in that sentence, and you do that throughout. So what sort of influence does poetry have on your work? Because you're, you know, obviously crime fiction is not poetry, and it's not meant to be.
Yeah, good point. I think my interest in the rhythm of sentences and the poetry in sentences, sort of quote-unquote, goes all the way back to being read to by my mom, which I can still remember really clearly. I can hear her voice still. When I was too young to read on my own, I'm talking 3, 4, I can remember back that far. I can remember the books that she read to me then, and the timbre of her voice and the way there was just such a natural built-in kind of poetry or harmony to the stories as read by mom, because she was such a great reader, you know. And so I think in some funny way those stories definitely stayed with me in terms of drama and emotion, and I can still feel the emotion when, you know, Shag, the last of the Plains Buffalo, you know, seeks his fortune in Yellowstone at the end of the book. And yet also I think what moved me was the rhythm of the language and the clarity and almost musicality that you get sometimes when sentences are moving by in a nice kind of unexpected, harmonious, sometimes contrapuntal way. I like that. I love the sound of things. And when I'm a reader, the first thing I note when I start reading a piece of fiction is the voice, the tone of voice. And if I can like that tone of voice after a page or two, say, I know I'm probably going to like the book, and I'm certainly going to finish it.
Do you have favorites?
Say what?
Do you have favorites? Favorite authors, favorite novels that you return to?
Yeah, I do. I think my most reread novel of my life is the novel that really, when I first read it, made me entertain thoughts of being a writer, and that is Joseph Heller's Catch 22.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, love that book. I reread it, you know, not often, but every, you know, several years, I pick it up and read it again. I always read Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You know, 100 Years of Solitude. I've read that a few times. I've hearkened back to The Old Man and the Sea and early Hemingway, you know, a lot. I've reread Tom McGuane's Panama 4 or 5 times. Those are some favorites of mine, you know. In terms of crime guys, you know, I've read a ton of Elmore Leonard, and I still read him even though he's no longer with us. And, you know, I'm a great fan of Don Winslow. I'm a great fan of the old spy master, John le Carré. So I have a long list of favorites. I got a bookshelf full of them.
So how do you remember how old you were when you first read Catch 22?
Yeah, I was 14 years old. I was a sophomore in high school, Miss Page's mythology and folklore class. And she was punishing our class because we were inattentive little brats. And we didn't want to learn mythology and folklore, and we misbehaved a lot, and she finally just brought our class to a halt one morning and said, I'm not going to teach you. I'm going to make you read, each of you read a paperback that I brought home from my for my garage, and they're in this box up here, and I want you to come up and close your eyes and pick one and take it back to your desk and read it so I don't have to listen to you anymore. She was furious at our class. And so when it was my turn to get up to the box beside her desk, I closed my eyes as ordered and reached in and picked out Joseph Heller's Catch 22. So it was completely happenstance, and if Miss Page hadn't been so mad at us for being lousy students and being rude to her, I may not have even read that book.
And then that was the time. That's when you read the book and you went, maybe I can do this?
Yeah, I did. I mean, the book changed my life for one thing. It took me 2 weeks to read it. I'm a slow reader, always have been, but I read every word of it, and I loved it. It changed the way I looked at things because it was looking at the world in a way that was different than my parents and my teachers and my Lutheran minister, and everybody around me was thinking, this was different. This was subversive. This was like opening a window in my little 14-year-old mind. And I remember thinking of the great pleasure I got from that book, you know, laughing and the chills at the battle scenes and stuff. And I remember thinking, you know, if you could be a writer someday and give a reader a fraction of the pleasure that you got out of Catch-22, you would have to consider yourself a successful guy. And it put the idea in my head that I could talk to people in that way.
Did your teacher know what was going on with you in terms of, you know, how this book affected you?
No, I don't think I ever talked to her about it. And I would love to, because I tell that story to audiences a lot when I tour and I'm asked about my beginnings. And I would love to run across Miss Page now and be able to thank her and everything. But I lost track of her. I don't know where she went. I have kept in touch with other high school teachers through the years, and still am, but she's not one of them. So if you're out there, Miss Page, thank you.
Yes, those Miss Pages, you know, teachers, I think of teachers that I've had that influenced me, and I wish they knew, you know. I think I made an effort to let some of them know, but I think others are gone, and, you know, I just, you know, teachers can have such influence.
Yeah, they really can. And you know what made her so angry with our class and made her quit teaching for that day and make us read paperbacks was how passionate she was about mythology and folklore. I mean, she's a great teacher, and she knew it up one side and down the other, and she was really, really strongly into it. And that frustrated her, I think. And yet, at the same time, I still carry some of that. I carry a little bit of that fire still. That I got through her, not just Joseph Heller, but the mythology and folklore itself.
Well, you know, something else I have appreciated about your fiction over the years, I think I've probably read every novel of yours, maybe missed one somewhere, but I don't think so somehow. There was one, the snake novel, I didn't read for a long time. And then finally I did. I'm like, oh, why did I not read this because of snakes? But anyway... One thing I've always appreciated about your fiction is how you balance scene with narrative summary, and I'm kind of focused on this lately because it seems to be the thing that really kind of makes or breaks a book. And I've directed students who are working on crime fiction especially to study your stuff because it's so seamless how you blend character detail with action and backstory. And so I'm curious if You got this from the books you read, the novels you mentioned, if this is something you got out of a class, if this is something you came upon yourself, or even if you know you're doing this.
I know what you're talking about, the kind of balancing of narrative exposition and then scene, you know, dialogue scenes, you know, real-time action, if you will. I think those two kind of different modes of writing are what make velocity in a book and drive velocity. And velocity is a good thing, I think, and it carries the reader along and it accelerates the story. And yet you need those two. You need narrative exposition in order to accelerate, and then you need real scene setting, second by second dialogue. And interaction to focus the story. So you need the two, and when you put the two together in such a way that when the reader's had enough of one, it's time for the other. That's the way you aspirate the book, I think, and that's the way you build momentum and velocity, which are really really important. I know as a reader, I like that. You know, I can get too much of one and too much of the other, but when it's kind of braided together, it's kind of nice. The two modes of storytelling kind of goose each other along, and I like that as a reader.
I like that, how they goose each other along. I'm going to remember that. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with T. Jefferson Parker. His new novel is The Last Good Guy. There is a love scene in this book that is so abbreviated. I appreciated it so much. And it's so, I'm trying to find it. I wish I could find it. I can't find it right now. But I don't know. I was trying to remember in other novels of yours how you dealt with love scenes. And this one I just appreciated so much because you're like, okay, here it is. It's not on the page. Okay, on to the next thing. Will you talk about that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think so. Are you talking about that longish paragraph that talks about what lovemaking can be?
Yeah.
All the different ways you can look at it.
I think so.
And that it can happen.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I've never done that before. I've tried, you know, all manner of approaches to writing, love scenes between characters in my books. Early on, I got kind of a little more detailed, maybe a little more lyrical about things. But over the years, I think that I came to believe and still do that kind of the less said, the better. I think less is more when it comes to writing scenes about lovemaking. And so, you know, rather than even write the scene in this book, I just have Roland kind of ruminating on all of the things that sex can be, that lovemaking can be, and he doesn't even come down on what exactly it was between him and his lover in that scene. He just kind of talks about how broad and what it can be, and so I kind of like that synoptic approach rather than anything where the physical, you know, machinations are delineated.
Yeah, I think I do too, actually. But it was great the way you did that. And I also love the outliers, the group of people that live on Roland Ford's land and in his compound, of a line of cabins with a main house and a pond. And I very much want to live there. I think that kind of setup would be great, right? To have, you know, people, like-minded people, hopefully, you know, living there, having their own spot, but being able to come together. And so I wondered if this is a setup you know of or long for.
Yeah, good question. I guess the latter, you know, and maybe a little bit of the former. You know what happened was Roland calls his little group of tenants. He rents these cabins to them, and he chooses people carefully because he wants to have interesting people around him, and he calls them the irregulars.
The irregulars,
they're all kind of interesting in their own way. And the reason that I even created the irregulars way back in book one of this series was that I realized if I was going to put, you know, widower Roland Ford in this sort of rambling, you know, half falling apart, you know, rancho hacienda house that he inherits from his wife's family, living alone there on 25 acres of woodland in North San Diego County, I'm going to be writing some pretty quiet books, you know. And so I had to give Roland someone to talk to. Literally, I had to give him a family. I had to give him a world, you know. And so that became the irregulars. And the irregulars are kind of three regulars, and then two more who kind of transfer in and out according to each book. There's different ones, so it's kind of a rotating cast, and it gives Roland someone to talk to, and they're often pretty funny, but the real purpose of the irregulars is comic relief and sort of social relief for Roland, but also they have managed in all three of the books to provide some sort of aid in Roland's life and in his work. In the first book, they actually help him set this bad guy up. In this third book, they sit Roland down and they grill him and they opine about Roland's new relationship and whether or not she is deserving of him. And so they kind of cast this moral. They're like a moral chorus when it comes to this book, and yet they can't even agree about what Roland should do with this woman. So they bicker and they try to guide him at the same time, and it's kind of funny and it's kind of instructive, I think.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. I'm like, I want that place. I want to live
there.
Yeah,
it's a great place.
It's a great place. Well, speaking of place, your books, you seem to place your books in settings close to where you live. And I, you know, authors often say, I can't write about it if I'm there. I have to move. I have to be somewhere else to write about a place. But you see, you do this. And so the last however many novels have taken place in Fallbrook. So talk a little bit about that, about your relationship to landscape and why you do that.
Yeah, happy to. You know, I love writing about where I live. That makes where I live interesting, more interesting than it is to start with, even if I get to write about it, you know. So I totally believe in that. I think there's no surer way to, you know, get to the truth of a place than by living there. And if you look back on this is my 25th book and novel, and if you look back on the 25, you can almost tell exactly where I was living by where the story set. You know, I always write about where I am, and I love it. I just love getting up in the wherever it may be. It could be in Laguna Beach, where I spent a lot of time, or Fallbrook, Tustin, where I grew up. It doesn't matter. When I can, you know, get up and look around me and go downtown, wherever it might be, and, you know, read the weekly paper of that little place where I'm living, I feel in full immersion, you know, and I really feel that I've always believed that, you know, the larger world, our larger America, if you will, or certainly the world, is best viewed small. You know, I'm a real believer in the microcosm, you know, so when I can find, like I did in Fallbrook 20 years ago, a small town that is emblematic, to my eye, of Main Street America, man, I want to live there. And I want to write about it. And that's what I've been doing.
Hmm. Yeah. And speaking of America, and we have, I think, 2 minutes left. But so I don't know how much we can say about America in 2 minutes. But the Last Good Guy deals with racism, deals with Holocaust questioners, deals with Trump, deals with the sex trade. How much of that did you know going in that you were going to touch on these themes?
I sketched those themes in a year ago when I began writing that book because they were so loud. They were so in the news, you know, Charlottesville, Me Too, white supremacists, you know, sexual transgressions. That all was quite, you know, quite loud a year ago. And now, weirdly enough, it's even louder. So they were good picks as far as durable subjects, if you will, because I think that problems such as those are going to be with us for a long time.
Yeah, and they are loud, but somehow you made it work where it, I don't know, the book doesn't feel stuffed with theme. You know, these things just kind of creep in and you go, yeah, okay, all right. It's kind of subtle, but I see it here, all right.
Good. I have no lesson to teach or axe to grind, but I want the truth of our times to be visible in my books, you know.
Jeff, this half hour has sped by. I wonder if you have any advice or last words for our listeners working on a novel.
Well, gosh, just, you know, read a lot and write well and don't let anybody take away the private, quiet time that you need to write, because that's the most valuable thing in the world. And tell Sigrid Nunes I'm a gigantic fan.
I will. Thank you so much.
All right.
That was T. Jefferson Parker. His new novel is The Last Good Guy. I love all his stuff. And whether you're working on crime fiction or not, this book and all of his books are great reads and studies in combining narrative summary with scene and bringing in lyrical writing and theme and all sorts of stuff. So that's it for this half hour. We'll be back with Sigrid Nunes. So don't go anywhere. Stay with us.
Oh, it's been such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you can email me at penonfire@earthlink.net. Love to hear from you. I'd love to hear what authors you'd love to see coming on the show. Anything you have to say, I would love to hear it. And Sigrid Nunez is with us. Sigrid has published 7 novels, including Feather on the Breath of God, For Rowena, The Last of Her Kind, and The Friend, which won the 2018 National Book Award for Fiction. She has so many honors, and you can read all about them on her website, sigridnunez.com. She's here to talk about Mitts, the Marmoset of Bloomsbury. Let's bring her on. Hi, Sigrid.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Great. I love Mitts. I loved this novel. I was surprised by it and would love to hear how it came about. I realize it's a reissue from 1998.
Yes, it is. It was published originally in hardcover in 1998, and then there was a Soft Skull paperback version of it, which was still in print, but then Soft Skull decided to reissue it with an afterword by Peter Cameron in a new edition, which just came out on August 6th. So the way it came about, it's interesting because it was all those years ago, I received a letter from the editor of a children's book editor, and she had read my first book, perhaps, and she said, I was wondering if you would ever be interested in writing something for children. And I said that I actually had always wanted to write a children's book. So she suggested that I come up with some idea and write a little bit and show it to her. So I had this idea. I happened to know that Leonard and Virginia Woolf had for about 4.5 years a pet monkey, a pet marmoset, which is a very, very, very small monkey. It would fit into the palm of your hand. And her name was Mitz, and I had read about Mitz in Virginia Woolf's diaries and letters and in Leonard Woolf's diaries and elsewhere. And I thought it would make an interesting story to write about Mitz. And also I knew, because I had read Virginia Woolf's fantastic novel called Flush, the least known of her books, but extremely beautiful, which was her own mock biography of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Cocker Spaniel, whose name was Flush. So I sat down, I wrote these three little chapters, and I had fun doing it, and then I sent them to the editor, and she didn't want them. She said that you can't write a children's book that doesn't have a child in it. But of course you can. I mean, there are such books. Anyway, so then I just forgot about it, and then sometime later at a book party for one of my then agent's authors, I happened to bring this up. We were talking about children's books, and then that word got around to my agent and through her around to my editor. By that time, I had published two novels with HarperCollins, and they were very interested. So I showed them the few pages that I had, the three little chapters, and they said they very much wanted to publish this mock biography of Mitz the Marmoset of Bloomsbury, but they didn't want it for children either. They wanted it to be a book for, as they put it, children of all ages. In other words, a book for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, that wasn't my idea. I wasn't sure that I could do that. But then I thought about Flush, which is certainly not a book for children. It is a book for adults. And with that as my model and my inspiration, I sat down and started all over again and wrote the book that has just been published.
Mm. Love it. Love the story. So that's really interesting that it started that way. And the tone, the style and the tone are really kind of different from the last book I read of yours, is The Friend. And it's so different in style, cadence, tone, and I find that so interesting and wonder how that is for you. I need to go back and read I have since acquired other novels of yours that I want to go back and read and again look at that. Every project is different for you. Every project requires a different style, different tone, different everything. How does that work?
Well, certain different elements, but I would say that a book like The Friend, which is my most recent book, actually is quite similar in tone to my very first book, and in style and even in structure to some extent. But with this particular book, it is a historical novel. It takes place in the 1930s, and it takes place in the UK and in Europe. And I wanted the style to reflect that era. So I had already read a great deal of Virginia Woolf, so I started rereading it and reading more from the Bloomsbury literature, and I really steeped myself in her language and in her style, because it very often in the book you are seeing things through her eyes, so that really is the difference there. You know, it had to sound like something that was taking place in a different time and in a different, very different society from any of the books that I've written.
You know, I wanted to also ask you about reissuing a book, and I was curious if you got to make any changes in what was published in 1998, or is it exactly the same as what came out then?
It's exactly the same.
Yeah, interesting.
The only difference is that we have this beautiful afterword by
yes.
Peter Cameron, and we also included a letter about the book that had been written by Nigel Nicholson, who was a biographer of Virginia Woolf, and also a young member of the Bloomsbury Circle, because his mother was Vida Sackville West, the great friend of Virginia Woolf.
In Mitts, the reader gets so much of Virginia and Leonard Woolf, as you said, and I read somewhere that a large percentage, I'm not sure, 90% or so of what we read in Mitts is true. Is that the case? And I'd love to hear more about the research you did for the Slim novel.
Well, yeah. It is as much nonfiction, or more nonfiction, actually, than fiction. I mean, I had to imagine what might be going through the heads of the various animals in the book. There's Mitts the marmoset, but there are two cocker spaniels, Pinta and Sally. Leonard and Virginia Woolf always had cats. They always had dogs. And so Pinta and Sally were real persons, dogs. And everyone else in the book, is a person that actually existed. You know, with one or two exceptions, minor characters. I already knew about Mitts, which is why I had the idea, and that was because I had come across Mitts in the letters and the journals. So I went back and I found everything, any time that Mitts was mentioned in either her work or her husband's work or someone else's work. And then I made a narrative out of that. But as you know, Virginia Woolf's diaries and also Leonard Woolf's diaries, they're very extensive. There's a lot of material there. And so I knew that they had her during this particular period for these 4.5 years. So then I studied very carefully what they were doing and thinking and what was going on in the world during those 4.5 years, in the first half of the 30s. And I put the story together from that. There's a lot in the book is in quotations, because they were things that were actually said or written by Virginia Woolf or her husband or her sister or whoever else in that group is in the story. So there is a great deal of nonfiction in the book. Part of the reason why I wanted to do this, and so it has come out, is that I wanted to write about them mm-hmm. and their world, not just the Mitts the marmoset. And I use this as a way of telling about their relationship. The book is very much about their marriage and what kind of writing lives they had. You know, they were writers, they were publishers, they were politically involved. It was a very turbulent time in Europe at the time, in the 30s, and all of that is in there. And none of it is invented.
Yeah, Mitts is a tremendous and yet subtle framing device. And the 4.5 years that you mentioned, is that pretty much due to the marmoset's lifespan?
Exactly. I mean, when they weren't sure when they got her how old she was, but they had been told that that marmosets in captivity only live about 4 years, and they had her for about 4.5 years, and then she died.
She saved them from Hitler.
That might be actually where the whole business began, because I remember coming across a letter in Virginia Woolf's letters, and I don't remember to whom she was writing at this moment, but she said she'd just come back from vacation with Leonard, and she wrote to a friend, "We're back. Did I tell you how the marmoset saved us from Hitler?" And I thought, "What? What is that?" And mm-hmm. there was a footnote. The editor of the letters had put in a little footnote about how they had gotten trapped in this Nazi parade while they were in Germany, and Mitts had distracted the very angry policeman who was coming at them with his very angrily, because they were where they shouldn't be, and they were very, very frightened. And so, you know, I Leonard Wolf wrote about that in his diary, and she wrote about it. That is one chapter in the book. And again, it happened the way I've written it, with a little bit of embroidery. That what happened was, and they were extremely frightened that they might get arrested, and then what? And they thought that it was a parade. They were waiting for Hitler, but in fact, the people had gathered because Goering was coming. And when the policeman came, very angry, and then he saw Mitz sitting on the steering wheel between Leonard's hands, he was so distracted and so charmed by this little monkey. And then the whole crowd around them was also very excited by it, and everybody was pointing. And then, you know, he said, "Okay, make way for Mitzi," because he had found out her name. And they got themselves out of the parade that way without mishap. So it's a wonderful anecdote.
Yeah, that's so interesting, and that chapter was just great. And, you know, I was curious, though, you have written nonfiction. You wrote a memoir of Susan Sontag, and because so much of what is in this novel is true, had you considered doing a story about Mitz and Virginia and Leonard Wolf as nonfiction?
No, because I wouldn't have written... No, because I, you know, because it's focused, you know, on the animal, you know, I wouldn't have written a nonfiction book, which had that focus. I mean, for example, I was really, as I say, thinking of Flush, which has a great deal of nonfiction in it as well. But in that book, pretty much of it through the point of view of that Cocker Spaniel, Virginia Woolf talks about the romance and marriage of Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning, and also that particular literary era. So it's very similar in that way, that the dog is very central to the story, but it also is something of a nonfiction book about them. So I would never have thought of I would never have thought of writing about, if I was going to write something nonfiction about the Wolves, it wouldn't have had anything to do with Mitz.
Right. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Sigrid Nunez. Her book that we're talking about is Mitz, The Marmoset of Bloomsbury, published by Soft Skull. It sounds like even before 1998, this book was given life, put aside. So I'm curious what your relationship is with revision, and if you have other projects that have sort of begun that you've put aside that you may return to, and when you know when something you start is not going to ever be finished, and if there are those projects in your life, or does everything at some point deserve a second look? Or a third?
I don't have a lot of things that have been set aside. I mean, this, I think, is a very specific situation because it was someone who wanted something very specific, a children's book. And then that idea was, as it was put to me, you can't make this a children's book. So I didn't even consider carrying on with it. I think for a lot of writers, probably pretty much anything that you might have started and abandoned is probably worth a second look, because there must have been some reason why you thought you had a book there. But I don't have anything else quite like that. But I do have things. I do have, story beginnings, story ideas, a noir that I wanted to write and publish, and that I got to a certain point that I sometimes think of going back, but I don't think so. That happens to a lot of writers.
Yeah. Well, what about short stories? You've placed short stories. You've been in the best of anthologies. What part do short stories play in your writing life?
Well, I've written a number of short stories over the years, And they've been published in various places and anthologized. And but I do think of myself as a novelist. I don't think I have a particular gift for short story writing, though I've done some and I've had some ideas. You know, I think in many ways it's a much harder genre, short story writing, than novel writing, even though one takes a lot longer. I mean, I you know, there is that famous Paris Review interview with Faulkner where he said, I wanted to be a poet, but I couldn't do that. I failed at that. And then I tried short story writing and couldn't do that. So, of course, I became a novelist. And I think there is some truth to that for me, too, that, of course, many writers can write one or two good short stories, but to be a really good, consistent short story writer who somebody like Alice Munro, or we could go all the way back to Chekhov, I think it's a whole other skill. As I think of myself as a novelist who sometimes writes short stories, sometimes writes short stories. I don't think of myself as a short story writer.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I'm always interested in novelists who write short stories and short story writers who write novels and sort of the different parts of the brain or creativity or perspective that you have to draw on. And it's interesting to do both, right?
Yes.
So I'm also interested in how awards change things for writers, and I'm curious what changed for you after winning the National Book Award, or did it? Did things proceed as usual, or did you have a different sort of confidence in your writing? I mean, you'd already had a number of books published, so maybe not, but did anything change?
Well, it's been less than a year because the award was announced last November. I do think it would have made much more of a difference if this had been a debut novel or even my second novel. Things probably would have been very different for me. But as you say, since I have been publishing all this time, I don't think it's had as significant an effect, certainly not on my writing. I had started writing another book after finishing The Friend. I'm still working on it, and I haven't noticed any change in any kind of decision I would make about that or any kind of progress I am or am not making on that book because of the prize. But I have become a lot busier since then, and that's been somewhat disruptive. But as I say, I really think it makes a very big difference when such a prize might come into your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of writing, could you talk a little about that? Do you outline, do you have an ending in mind when you begin, or is it really a process of discovery for you?
So I'm one of those writers who never has an outline. And I don't miss it. For some writers, it's very helpful to have that. For some writers, it's even necessary. And for me, I think it would be a hindrance because I don't like the idea of knowing too much about something that I'm beginning, particularly if it's going to be long. I kind of like the idea of sort of groping my way intuitively rather than committing myself to anything. And then as the thing grows, by necessity, you're more and more committed. You've created situations that have to be, carried through, or, you've got a tighter focus as you move on. And then I may very well think that I have an ending or some other part in the future and be very excited about it and think it's very good, a very good idea. And then by the time I get to that point, that won't work anymore. And that's what I mean about never really wanting to be too committed to any idea I might have beforehand. So that way, as I say, well, that looked like a good idea, but now let's go here instead because that doesn't feel right anymore. I mean, occasionally I will get to a certain point where I do think, oh, I know how this should end, and then I do write to that ending. But just as often, I don't know until I get to the ending.
And then when you go back into revising, do your first chapters, the first chapters of the first drafts, remain usually, or do they completely change?
They don't change. They don't change. That's exactly my process, and it has been the same for every single book. So obviously that's, you know, who I am as a writer and what works for me. I start at the beginning with a few ideas, trying not to be too committed to anything, and I kind of creep along, and I write the thing as I go along linearly, and I revise all the pages as I'm writing, so that by the time I get to the end, you know, I have been revising all the way through, but, you know, not in dramatic ways, always in incremental ways. And so by the time I'm finished, the book really is finished. I might have some polishing or correcting to do, straightening out things, getting rid of certain things that don't work, but I don't do a major revision. No, I don't have to do that because I've done all the work as I go along.
Has it always been this way for you since you started writing?
Yeah, it has. It has. I've always worked that way with novels. Well, with stories, too. That is how I work.
It seems like it would be a great time saver since so many writers spend so much time revising and, you know, recasting and changing everything.
I think it has something to do with, you know, how you hold the whole thing in your head. I mean, for some, I know that there are some writers who it's absolutely necessary to them to get the entire thing down. No matter how sloppy, no matter how much revision will need to be done, they have to have the whole thing down before they can go back and make it something good. Other writers sit and think and think and think and think without writing about what they're going to write, and then they sit down and they write it as it comes to them, making almost no changes at all as they go along. To me, that's the most remarkable kind of writer,
mm-hmm.
who just, you know, they don't revise. They've just done so much thinking before they sit down and do it that it just kind of pours out of them.
Yeah, that's enviable. I love it. I love it. Sigrid Nunez, thank you so much for taking the time to come back on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Mitz is just wonderful. I'm so glad I got to read it. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Sigrid Nunez. Her novel is Mitz, The Marmoset of Bloomsbury. It's a lovely, lovely novel. And especially if you're a Virginia Woolf fan, you must read it. It's just great. That's all we have today. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett still. And the show, along with all the others, will be up on iTunes, hopefully within the next couple of days. Thank you for listening, and remember to stay in the chair.